Hello, everyone. I'm Darian Gold, and welcome to All Things Pilates Season 5. There is a collective fascination with Joe Pilates, his method, and inventions. The exercise paradigm continues to evolve, as does our understanding of Joe's genius. So join us, because we know there is always more to explore. Now part of the Penguin Random House Author Club, Gwen Miller is all smiles and is here to share what it's like to be a new published author. Last season, Gwen helped us understand about various spinal pathologies and how she was preparing for the publication of her upcoming book, Safe Movement for All Spines. Today, I thought we'd like to hear from Gwen again about how it felt to see her book in print, what the response has been, and what she hopes to accomplish with her book. Welcome back to the show, Gwen.
Thank you, Darian. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, you look great. Even though we're just doing audio, I want my listeners to know this is one happy lady and she looks fabulous.
Oh, well, thanks, Darian. And likewise, we're doing what we love, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, congratulations first. And I know all of us would like to know what it felt like to actually see your book finally in print.
It was amazing. I felt in awe when I opened up the book from Penguin Random House, and my publisher is North Atlantic Books. They are located in Berkeley, California, and they are a subsidiary of PRH. Big Box came from Penguin Random House, and I almost was in reverence or awe somehow of it was actually there. And when I opened up the box and I saw the book, and I'd seen art of the cover before, and so I was familiar with how it was going to look like. But when I picked up the first copy of the book that I actually held in my hands and I felt the heft of it and thumbed through the pages, it was amazing. I felt so many things: happiness, joy, elation, satisfaction, and a little bit of emotion, like just almost like I wanted to cry, but it wasn't a crying moment, but I did feel some emotion. What was really sweet about that moment was that my son Sam was there with me, and he was the photographer for the still pictures in the book. So he had a big part in helping make it happen. I couldn't have done it without all the people that helped, frankly. When I sent out thank you copies to the people that helped with all the reading and illustration, videos, still photos, editing, it was about 35 people.
Wow.
It was a lot of people. I had a lot of people read this book from different backgrounds to make sure that not only was it something that would be useful in a Pilates or yoga studio or for a personal trainer, but also that if someone was a layperson, a non-fitness industry professional, that they would be able to understand the book, the content, and that it would be useful to them as well.
How long did it take you to write the book?
It was about a 5-year process from really starting to figure out how to present the material to the end of the editing process. There was a couple of years where I made serious false starts, I call them, and wrote chapters, wrote an intro, wrote a chapter one, mapped out with post-it notes on a foam core board content. And I wrote the first time I tried writing it, it was the intro and the chapter one, and chapter one was all about assessment. When I got done with chapter one, I was like, I have now bored myself. No one is going to read this. So when I finally hit on the one topic per chapter format, and then was inspired to share a personal story about someone that I actually know, and in one of the chapters, it's actually me, I began to write and did a brain dump, essentially, based on 20 years of working with people who have the conditions in the book. And that took at least a year and a half. But then once you find a publisher, I mean, the initial copy that I sent to the publisher had already been edited. We were already in third draft. And then you've got multiple editing processes as the publisher returns the manuscript to you. Then there's sourcing the illustrations. There's the photographs. There's the source citations.
Okay, wait a second. Wait a second. You sent it to one publishing house and one of the largest on the planet?
They were my first choice.
All right, you don't mess around.
One of the people that I work with is a well-known author, poet. And when I was trying to figure out who to choose for my publisher, I looked at my own library, first of all, and I said, who's published the books that I read? Then I just simply did an internet search and health and fitness publishers, top 17, and I came up with North Atlantic Books. And the reason that they were my first choice is because they're a local nonprofit and they're owned by Penguin Random House. So I was like, ooh, best of both worlds. They have social conscience. So they wanted to serve underserved populations. And they were someone that was in my time zone that if I needed to go have a face-to-face meeting with, I could. And that was on the advice of my client friend. So they were my very first choice. It's a massive undertaking just to submit an application to a publisher. There's a lot of material and information and questions that they ask you to answer. And when I sent that in...
Was that overwhelming? Or you were prepared for it?
I think that I saw a quote recently about overwhelm. And the quote, it was from Abraham Hicks. Overwhelm is when the universe is giving you what you've asked for and you're not quite prepared for it yet. So if we reframe that to when I saw this list of questions, I realized that there were some areas that I really needed to think about and do a deep dive and develop more.
I love that quote.
Me too.
What has the response been like?
Overwhelmingly positive. Every person who has picked up the book has commented positively about the layout, the ease of use, the readability, the way it's organized, and the content itself. So I'm very, very happy that my goal of having it be a useful resource for multiple people from multiple backgrounds and experience levels has been accomplished. In good part, that was because I had so many people read it.
Are you doing book signings?
I am. I've done 3 book signings so far, and I have 3 more currently scheduled. The next book signing is June 17th. That one is going to be in the East Bay in Hayward. That is a special one for me. My mom did her book signing at B Street Books, which is now called Books on B. And the Sun Gallery is a place where my high school art teacher participated quite a bit. And he inspired me enough that I ended up with a studio art minor in college. And they have partnered to host me at an author event. And it's just really special. After that, July 22nd, I will be at Breathe Diversity Pilates and Fitness, which is co-owned by two of my colleague friends, Charisse Mikkel and Sonia Monk is what I used to call her, but that's not her last name now. And then in September, I believe it's the 17th, I'll be at Reader's Books in Sonoma.
It's wonderful. I mean, of course you're doing book signings because I was at one and it was this gorgeous vineyard. Or do you call it a winery?
I think I would call it a vineyard. I would call it an estate, actually. I was very fortunate to have the Ellsbury's host me at their home.
Gwen, there are many books right now available about the spine, spinal conditions, spinal disorders. What makes your book different? Why is someone going to pick up your book?
Well, that's a really good question. And that's one of the questions actually the publisher asked me, like, how is your book different? And it's different in a few key ways. One big difference is that it covers not just one modality. There's a lot out there about Pilates for certain conditions, like Pilates for postural faults, for example, or Pilates for scoliosis. And then there's yoga structural therapy books. Okay, Mukunda Stiles' yoga therapy book is a classic in that genre. And then there are fitness genre books like Built from Broken, for example, that is really more for personal trainers. In my world, in my mind, movement is movement. We have different names that we call specific movements. We may have different ways that we approach certain movements. However, there's only so many ways the human body can move. So no matter what language a person speaks, whether it is the language of Pilates or the language of yoga or personal training, I wanted to be able to offer this information as a resource, no matter where that person works or works out. So that is one important difference. And the other important difference is that it's really written for teachers and for lay people so that a teacher can use it as the resource, as we discussed earlier. The lay person can understand more about their body because we know that at some level, the lay person or the student or client needs to be able to take responsibility for their own body. We can't be always guarding and protecting our clientele. We need to educate them to be able to be in touch with their bodies enough that they can do that for themselves. And this is getting into the idea of nervous system work, right? So we have co-regulation where we work with someone, we help to educate and inspire them, and then they learn from that self-regulation. This is how my body can move, right? This is how I can be in charge of myself. So in those two ways, I felt that my book was quite different. And the other piece of that is that when I looked at books that were written for lay people, I felt like they were really dumbed down. Most of them, all of them that I saw were so dumbed down, I felt like they were almost an insult to the intelligence of people reading them. And I thought, you know, we're smarter than that. And so I tried to write it in a way that would be intelligent, but not talking down to or over the heads of anybody. I have plenty of books that I almost need to have a dictionary next to me while I'm reading them. Anytime we're reading or we're having a conversation or we're listening to a lecture, if there's a word that we don't understand the definition of, our learning stops at that word until we understand that word. And I did not want the learning to stop anywhere in my book.
Those were the answers. Those were great answers to that question. And you sold it.
Thanks, Darian.
You sold it right there. Okay, so ultimately, where do you want this book to land if you had your way? You snap your fingers and your book is?
My book is in households of people who have spinal, sacral, sciatica, hip, hypermobility, scoliosis. My book is in teacher training programs for Pilates, yoga, and personal training. My book is in colleges and junior colleges that teach certificate programs as a special populations addition to the curriculum. My book is in chiropractic colleges, physical therapy colleges. I see the biggest service is to get information out that is in a way is a usable resource so that students and clients and future teachers and even experienced teachers can just have a little backup. Let's make our lives easier, people. How about this? How about I can't keep everything in my brain 100% of the time? And I know I've worked with this type of client before, but if I have just a book, I can open up and go to the back of the chapter and look at my section for whatever I'm teaching. And I can just have a few little pointers. Do this, don't do that. Okay, we're good. Let's go. You know, it just takes the stress out of it. It takes the effort. And then we can do what we're really brilliant at, which is teach. We are free to teach. We can spread our wings. We can help our clients spread their wings. That's where I see it.
Beautiful. Perfect. Can I ask you about bone density?
Absolutely.
As we age, is it inevitable that most of us will end up with osteopenia or osteoarthritis?
Or osteoporosis?
Yes.
So osteopenia is different from osteoarthritis, although they can go hand in hand. The idea of bone density is that's more of an osteopenia and then osteoporosis conversation. And if you would ask me if that's inevitable, I would say no, it's not inevitable. There are certain things that we cannot change, and that one of them is our genetics. So as a smaller person, a smaller boned, if you will, person, you might have more likelihood of developing a bone density loss than a larger person like myself. But that's not always true. You know, a lot of it has to do with how active are you? You are a lifelong athlete, right? So that counterbalances that. So you've got the genetics of your body type and you've got your lifestyle that determines the expression of those genetics to good part. So I feel that osteopenia can be tied in some ways to sarcopenia, which is muscle loss. Now, as we age, we are reducing the level of key hormones in our bodies, namely estrogen for women and testosterone for men. And these key hormones play a part in our bone density. So that's something that if we are just letting that progress go naturally, that's something that we can't necessarily do something about unless we seek medical intervention. However, we can exercise more. If we are losing muscle mass, that's called sarcopenia. If we are statistically losing between 1 and 3% of our muscle mass every year, that can build up to a very large number between the ages of 40 and 80, for example. So we need to actually exercise more as we age to counteract that natural loss. So there's a natural progression in aging, and there's also an intentional work that we can do to
stave off.
That's right. So if one of the pieces that I've been working on to kind of blog about is staying the same good enough? And when I was working with a couple, I love these people. They actually helped read the book too, in their 80s. And, you know, talking about this idea that we have of progression or improvement, it's sort of always there out in the air. And the husband said, he said, well, I think that as I'm getting older, if I'm staying the same, that's actually progress. And it just took me aback. This was several years ago. And I thought, you know, he's right. Because if we're staying the same, that implies that we're chronologically getting older, but we're biologically, we've kind of put the brakes on because of the intentional application of exercise along with other lifestyle factors naturally. So no, I don't think it's necessarily true that that's the end result for everybody. No. One of the people that I've studied with in the last couple of years that I respect a lot, and I respect everybody I've studied with really, but Dr. Suzanne Martin, and I was taking a Zoom class with her over the pandemic. It was something about spinal asymmetry, and I believe she's got a book by the same name. And while she was switching props on the trapeze table in between some exercise demonstrations, she was talking about the idea of sarcopenia. And I had always heard it being the 1% to 3% a year. And she said, first time I'd ever heard this, it scared the living daylights out of me. She said that at 1% to 3% a year, between 40 and 80, you can actually lose 50% of your muscle mass if you do nothing. 5-0. And it blew my mind. And I thought to myself immediately about the people that I've seen who were very elderly and with thighs as big around as my forearm, not able to stand anymore. And I thought, that's what happened. They just lost all that muscle mass. So we have to keep moving. And this is the driving force behind getting the word out about this book. This is my driving force, that I believe, and I know you believe too, Darian, that exercise heals, that movement heals, that we need to keep moving. It's not like some optional thing. We have to keep moving. So even when life happens, things happen, our spines age, whatever it is, we still need the movement. And so to make that movement possible for people, that keeps them safe, in other words, keeps them from exacerbating an existing condition or creating a problem, sometimes we need a little bit more information.
Agreed. Okay, Gwen, your book, besides it being a beautiful cover, wait till you all get your copy. It has 11 chapters. And chapter 10, you have special cases. Will you tell us about that chapter?
That chapter has a case study of a friend of mine who came to me after many, many, many years, decades, in fact, of back pain and many, many, many visits to doctors who ultimately ended up sending her to psychiatrists for medication because they couldn't see anything in her X-ray to show or to verify or validate the experience that she was having in her body of constant pain.
That sounds like long COVID. The doctors don't understand. So they send you to a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
They don't understand.
It sounds like so many things, doesn't it? And we have to be aware that the doctors have their paradigm. We love our doctors. We partner with our doctors. And thank goodness we have so many interventions that we do. The point that I'm making here is that she had a complicated back. She had a complicated spine. So the reason I chose her for the case study in that chapter is because there was more than one thing going on. Now, it'd be really great if everybody who walked into our studios or clinics had only osteoporosis or only spinal stenosis. But often we find there is more than one thing going on at a time. And sometimes those things that are going on are contradicting each other as far as the movements that are indicated that are best practice movements. So I wrote the chapter with the intention of illustrating this point, like what happens when, and then a rubric for thinking about what are the priorities. Like there's some of the spinal conditions that if we backbend, it might not feel comfortable. It might cause a little pain. But it's ultimately, it's not really dangerous. But then there are some where it could be dangerous for the person. And the same thing with the forward flexion. So to be able to develop a hierarchy of decision making and a priority. And what I do here too is illustrate, like, let's look at what is the same between those two apparently conflicting conditions. So there are some places that are the same place or the same advice, if you will, in dealing with both. So you start there, but we need to identify that and then proceed from there. And then the hierarchy has to do with where can we best serve the person? What do we need to make sure that we do not do to avoid harm while we're helping them to become stronger so that we can then move forward into just life.
And balance in the body.
Correct. Yes, balance in the body. Mm-hmm.
And how is this client today?
She's wonderful.
Is she pain-free?
Yes, she is pain-free. And the clients that I've had that have come in after a long journey, the ability for them to reclaim their lives, it's priceless. It's a beautiful thing. I feel privileged to be able to help people in that way. And part of it is finding an area of pain-free movement. And sometimes that's like all I would do the first session. But then also, once someone has reclaimed their wellness, so to speak, their pain-free state, they all get a program that I call an SOS program, so that when they feel that old thing is going to come back, and you know what I mean, anybody who's had sciatica, you can feel the place where the nerve runs, and it's just like, it'll talk to you. And it's not there yet, but you know, okay, that's my sign. So I teach them to identify their warning sign, and then they go into their corrective program right away. And that's the SOS program. So again, we have an empowerment of the person to take charge of their condition, which erases fear. And fear is something that can create its own pain response. As a matter of fact, in the pain science that I'm not an expert in, but I've read a little bit enough about pain science to make me dangerous. But the idea is that pain is multifactorial. It doesn't always correlate with tissue damage. It doesn't always correlate with posture. So a person can have pain, and there's got to be three things in place. And one of the things that could be in place to experience pain might be fear of experiencing pain, along with a couple of other things. Okay. So you think about that, and you think, why do football players get right back up off the ground after they've been hit, where if I got hit like that, I would still be there in a fetal position just going, I'm done, you know. And it's because they don't correlate. They don't have a fear that that hit is something that was life-threatening or dangerous to them, where to me or you, we would interpret that information differently.
Great point. And then speaking of pain moving into healing, your chapter 11, your last chapter, it's called The Language of Healing, which is such a beautiful title. You deliver a meaningful message about the concept of healing and the responsibility teachers have in being a facilitator of healing. Will you speak about this?
Sure. That chapter came straight from my heart. That chapter was not part of the initial design for the book, and yet I felt that it was really important to address, because we are working with human beings. And when someone comes into our studio or our clinic or our whatever their the club, wherever we are, they are vulnerable. They're actually coming in because they're asking for help. And to ask for help is vulnerability. And so to meet that vulnerability by intentionally creating a space of safety, I think it's very important. And we can create that safe space for communication to occur by being very thoughtful about our spoken words and our physical responses. So if we are very careful to meet someone's eyes and remain open and really listen to them, as opposed to any other types of brush off, eye rolling, you know, dismissive kind of behaviors that, of course, we would never do, but just as a real juxtaposition there. So I have a few examples from my personal experience that I have in that chapter of ways that I have changed my languaging around communication to look at keywords or key phrases that I have found have served me better in creating an open communication environment for people that come to see me.
And getting better results because of.
That's right. Because if we have someone who feels safe, they then will actually tell us more about what they're feeling. They will feel like they can communicate what they're feeling, and then we can respond to that. If they do not feel safe for any reason, and it might not be us, they may have a long history of not being heard. Okay, so if they don't feel open to being able to really communicate what they're feeling, then we can't address it. So it's like somebody who comes to you after class and says, you know, that exercise we were doing, I really didn't feel that hurt my SI joint. And you're like, I wish you would have said it during class, because I could have addressed it then. I don't want you to keep going if you're feeling pain. You know, this is like an example of the, I'm sure that we have, many of us have experienced that. And yeah, so, but being able to have that, hold that space for someone to really communicate with us and have it be okay for them to let us know if something's working or not working. And also the way that we cue too, the way that we cue, if we're inclusive in our cueing, I'm actually playing with the idea of removing words like progression and advancement out of my vocabulary right now. This is something that just is.
You mean because it puts pressure on a student?
Because it makes
expectations.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But it's not just that. I think we have an internal drive, most of us, to do well and to perform well for a teacher. You know, we want to be the, at least I do, I want to be the student, you know, this, I'm going to do whatever you say, you know, but it also, I think devalues where the student is currently. And so if I am told that I'm doing an exercise, and if I'm in a class, for example, and then the instructor were to say, so if you want to progress that, then do this. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I guess I want to progress that. I guess that
wasn't
means
good
that
enough. What I did.
Exactly. One of the best pieces of advice personally I received for my own body in my yoga practice was from my friend Ulrika Ingman, who was an Anyasara yoga teacher, instructor trainer at that time. And she saw me doing the chaturanga to upward facing dog transition. And my shoulders are tight, as you know. And she told me that even though I was strong enough to make that transition, she said, you are going to hurt your shoulders. And so she said, I belonged in the baby cobra pose. She told me, lower all the way down to the floor, don't do the transition in the air, and then just roll your shoulders back and do, it's our baby swan in our Pilates. And I appreciated that so much. I had to be a little bit like, okay, my ego is...
Well, she gave you permission.
Yes, she gave me permission and she told me why. And so I think from that experience, I realized, you know, we're not all built in a way, and we sometimes don't have in place the physical training or ability or background, or maybe not even the physical makeup to be able to execute the nth degree of every single exercise or pose or whatever it is. So that's why. And I think now what I do is, what I've done for many, many years is I'll just say, like, if you need more, I'll start off with the basic and just, if you need more, here's an option. If that doesn't appeal to you, then go back to the previous version kind of thing. And so kind of making it to be pleasing for people that may be there for different, you know, everyone's got some repertoire that they're good at. And some people, there are certain repertoire that maybe it's just not the right thing for their bodies, except you, Darian, you do it all perfectly. Every time I've seen you, it's like, oh my gosh, she's so amazing.
Well, let me ask you to that point. In your opinion, do you think it's important or vital that the teacher has his or her own practice so that if the student doesn't really understand your words or doesn't visually understand maybe other students are practicing an exercise, that you're able to demonstrate to a degree that the student then would say, oh, I'm going to keep that visual in my head while I'm developing my strength to one day be able to do that exercise?
I think that the teacher's personal practice is where the words come from. I feel in my own body as I'm cueing what the movement or intention of the exercise is that I'm cueing while I'm cueing it. It's like a visualization that's coming out my mouth. So I think it is incredibly important. Now, that being said, I do think that if an instructor has something going on with their body where they could potentially do harm to their body by doing a demonstration.
Especially cold.
Yes. And especially we do tend to demonstrate our strength poses on our strong side and our flexibility poses on our flexible side, for example, perpetuating maybe muscle imbalances in that way. I believe that another good way of instructing visually is to spotlight a student who has the ability to do the exercise and have them be the demonstration. I will, to this day, as I'm walking around teaching my SpineSafe mat class in person now, drop down on the floor between mats and show someone how to do single long leg stretch, for example, if they're just not, you know, quite understanding the words. Many people are visual or kinesthetic learners, and so I think that's an important ability. I also think that at some point we transition from doing as much demo and we really use our words, because if we're demoing down on the mat, we can't see what's going on. And our visual, our teacher's eye informs how we're cueing. But yes, we need the practice. And we also need the practice because that's what helps keep our bodies healthy. The number one thing I hear from my student teachers when they graduate with their comprehensive, they've done all their work and they begin teaching and they're working and working, is that their personal practice becomes secondary to scheduling with their clients. Number one. And that is something I have done. And it's an easy thing to let your personal practice time go when you have a client that says, I want to schedule, and this is like the only time I can make it. It happens to be the time you earmarked. Well, guess what? If you say that time's not available, they will find another time to work with you.
That's good advice.
Oh, and it's advice that I keep following and reiterating for myself. It is so easy to let that part of our lives go. Why did we get into teaching movement? It's because we loved it. And so then why is it so easy to let that go?
Because I think sometimes we put ourselves on the back burner.
Yep.
Specifically because we want to share our love and passion. And so sometimes we sacrifice our own sense of wanting to stay healthy, because you know that your students need you, love you, want you, and learn from you, and you see how they develop, and you want them to continue to be happy in their bodies.
Yes. And it's beautiful and it's inspiring, and it's why we do what we do. It's a labor of love. And ultimately, and Dr. Tom Hendrickson said this to me about some of the techniques that we do in the manual therapy, in the orthopedic manual therapy, where we're coming from our legs and we're being careful with our back position and we're using different hand positions. If we wear our own bodies out or we neglect our bodies, then our careers are cut short. It is by keeping ourselves healthy that we can serve many more people over many more years. So it just, we need to keep uplifting that idea in our fitness culture, in our Pilates and yoga and personal training culture, that is really as important, maybe even more important than the service to our clients, because we are in service.
Gwen, how and where can people purchase your fabulous book?
Well, it's all over the place. So if you are a studio owner or a bookstore that would like to stock the book for sale for your clientele, you can purchase the book on Ingram, or you can purchase from Penguin Random House, and I can send the correct link for that. So those folks could just email me or text me after the show, and I'm happy to share that information. The book is on multiple websites, including Amazon, on which I have an author profile. So you can follow me when I start blogging again, you'll get updates. It is on Barnes & Noble, Copperfields, Goodreads, and more. On my website, GwenMillerStudio.com, if you look at the book page, there are live links to all of those different booksellers. And if you have a special bookstore that you like to go to that you would like to support, you can go in, and if they do not have the book stocked, request them to order it for you from Ingram. And that way the bookstore gets the profit from the book.
Wonderful. The best way to contact you then isn't through an email, it's through your website.
Well, the website, it has a contact page. So my email is gwenamy@sonic.net. And my website, Gwen Miller Studio, has a contact page, and they both will be just as good.
I'm excited for my listeners to purchase such a comprehensive book. And I want to thank you for your time, Gwen, and congratulations again. I'm super excited for you and all your book signings. And is there another book in your future?
Well, there is. I have been writing a book, and I was writing two books at the same time. They both got to about 25,000 words, and I had to table the first one to be able to finish this one. What I'm currently working on is the Dynamic Spine, which is a advanced continuing education project for teachers that is based on the book. And that is in its second year. And I am happy to talk with people about that as well. As soon as I've finished adding to the curriculum and getting through all of these book signings and all the wonderful excitement of this year, I will circle back and resume writing the other book.
Sounds very good, Gwen.
Thanks, Darian.
Yeah. Yes.
That's exciting.
Thank you, Gwen, for your time and your knowledge and your open heart to share all that you know.
I appreciate you, Darian. Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure chatting, and I look forward to every time we do.
All Things Pilates is produced, written, edited, and hosted by me, Darian Gold. Mastered audio mix by Fabian Romero. This season, we have all original music by AKA Johnny. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast, you have the opportunity to support it for as little as $3 a month. You'll see the link in the show notes, and just know that every dollar helps me continue to bring you the most interesting guests in the Pilates community. How strong is your spine? How well do you treat the very column that holds you up? Sometimes people act in a spineless manner, and I wonder if that's because there's a lack of spinal strength and awareness attached to that behavior. Do you think if we maintain a healthy spine, it might give us the confidence to speak up and to literally stand up for ourselves? Thanks so much for being with us, and meet you here in a couple of weeks for another episode of All Things Pilates.